The bids on MEVCommit are additive, so you don't actually have to send your transaction to MEVCommit. You can send it to whatever you're sending it on today. As long as the builder receives it, we don't ask MEV searchers to, you know, now start sending their transactions over MEVCommit or something like that. They send it as they are, they behave as they do. They just have additional optionality now to influence how that block might be built.
Scraping Bits is brought to you by the following sponsors. MEV Protocol. Maximize your ETH staking value with MEV ETH, exclusively on MEV.io. And Composable. Execute any intent on any chain, coming soon to Mantis.app. That's MANTIS.APP. And Fastlane Labs, the only MEV and intent-centric team that has a daily deodorant application rate of over 68%.
GM, everyone. My name's Degarchi, the host of Scraping Bits. And today, I have with Murat from Primev. How's it going?
Going very well. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for coming on. Just for the people that aren't familiar with you, who are you and what do you do?
Definitely. I'm founder and CEO at Primev. I have a background in product and been in the space since pretty much day one. I was on Reddit when the Bitcoin dropped. You know, people were talking about this Bitcoin thing and it intrigued me. Most recently, I was product lead at Block and a mainnet block builder and a relay operator.
Oh, you're a relay. Oh, yes, because of a Block Native. Let's say initially, how did you get into all this? Since Bitcoin inception is quite a long time. So what were you doing before and how did you get into crypto initially?
Yeah, I mean, I grew up in Turkey and my family's half American. So I was going back and forth my whole life. And I always had this notion of currencies, right? You know, on my birthday, I'd get like $100 from a family member or something. And I would watch how many Turkish liras that was worth and how many, you know, bags of chips I could buy. So this notion of currency was always subjective to me. And, you know, been a techie and whatnot. So when the Bitcoin white paper dropped, and I saw it on Reddit, it just immediately resonated with me that, you know, the notion of money is this thing that is kind of made up and that you could actually have a more robust constructions using algorithms and some simple resistance mechanism like proof of work. And I just got pretty enamored with the idea that I could just generate these coins with my computer and use them to interact with people in a financial medium online without really knowing who they are, et cetera. So I started mining and trading in the early days, and that kind of led me down a path of exploring the tech more and more.
Interesting. Were you doing MEV before PBS was even a thing?
Well, in 2014, I was trading on Coinbase, and they put out their API documentation. And I was like, huh, nice. I could just code my strategy in Python and like leverage this thing. I started doing that, hooked it up to a bunch of exchanges, crashed some South African exchange with a bunch of...
Oh, wait, what?
Yeah, you know, I was a novice coder and, you know, I'm still not the best coder in the world or anything, but my algorithm just didn't have any controls for, you know, the liquidity at the, you know, exchange that it would send Bitcoin to. So it just was like, oh yeah, sell this Bitcoin that I sent it over there. And then there was no liquidity in that market to like absorb that. So it just kind of crashed the price. And markets were super inefficient back then. You know, you would have some Bitcoin price that, you know, $80 over here and it was $200 over there. It was fun times.
Interesting. And then how did you get into MEV then? So skip a few years, I assume.
Yeah, skip a bunch of years. There's a part in, I think, around 2017 where I created the first social wallet on Ethereum and ran into this problem of not having enough infrastructure services to power the types of experience that I had wanted to. And that led me into working with infrastructure, which the move to Block Native happened under. We launched Mempool Explorer in DeFi Summer at Block Native, and it was kind of a magical moment in DeFi because it was the first time that you could interact with a kind of a no-code mempool stream authoring environment. And it blew up and, you know, influencers were, you know, front-running people on podcasts, you know, using this thing and whatnot. And it just kind of made us a magnet for all sort of MEV people to use, to talk to ask and educate and all sorts of things. So we were kind of doing stuff with the advent of MEV, I would say. And, you know, shortly after Flashbots created, I think it was Mevgeth at the time, and, you know, part of the, I think 3% or so, or maybe 5% of the mempool started going dark because of this. And then, you know, it actually started being minor extractable value, and searchers started emerging and interacting with those platforms.
When you're at Blocknative, were you doing, this was, I guess there wasn't even a relay at the time before PBS. Yeah. So what were you doing at Blocknative before PBS then?
Yeah, I was product lead, right? So, I mean,
So what does that really mean in this realm?
So I was, product people just listen to users and people. That's like what their role is. It's like, hey, okay, you know, we created this thing, but like, what are people using it for? And you can think of the, you know, the common cotton swab as like a good answer. Like, you're not supposed to put it in your ear, right? It's supposed to be for some other stuff, but everyone just, you know, cleans their ear with that. So the product person really talks to the user and understands like, what are they trying to do? What are they using this product for? And how can I better serve this person or, you know, group of people and evolve our product and communicate the needs to the team of what this product needs to do and kind of map that out. So you're kind of a leader for the product, not really for the organization, but for the product and the people that are building it and are, you know, using it and are, you know, entangled with it. So we had, go ahead.
I think being product is, it doesn't sound super fancy, but it is super important. What do you think like separates a great product guy from a mediocre?
How in tune you are with the users. And I mean, there's a lot there with regard, like utilizing engineering resources and being able to prioritize them really well, coming up with creative solutions for things that, let's say, you know, will take a month, but you will scope down the product need in a way where you can ship something out much faster and get that user satisfied. Maybe it's not the ultimate solution that the user wants, but at least it'll kind of keep them moving. And then, you know, basically being that other part of the brain for the engineering team so that they can continue focusing on what they do best. And you can point out, hey, you know, maybe we don't fully solve this. We just leverage this workaround that already exists, you know, ship a solution in 2-3 days and, you know, have the user be happy. And in that meantime, we can allocate our engineering resources to something that, you know, furthers some other goal. So I think it's a lot of optimization, prioritization, and leadership when it comes to both technology and creative solutions.
Right. Interesting. What was like the point where you decided to bring your expertise to Primev? Like what caused that shift? And what did you identify that made you go, wait, I need to build a product around this? What was that turning
point? User problems. You know, we operated a mainnet block builder. Our users were searchers and other transaction originators that were sending us transactions. And they were like, well, I'm sending you transactions and sometimes they don't land on chain, which is still a problem, right? I want to guarantee that it's going to land on chain on this block that I specify. Well, wait a minute, we had 10%, you know, 15% of the network share. So that meant 85% of the time, we can't give you that guarantee. And you can't get that guarantee elsewhere either, because the other block builder has, you know, 20%, 30% of the network. So I was invited to the MevBoost stewards gathering in DevCon Bogota with folks from Flashbots and the Ethereum Foundation. And I, you know, presented this idea. Well, what if we had a network of these block builders and users just had to interact with the network rather than a single block builder at a time? The network could give these guarantees. That resonated with people. And they encouraged me to pursue it. It eventually became Primev. And, you know, here we are a year and a half later with, you know, a live network on Holsky Testnet.
Nice. And what was the first question is Blocknative using you?
So Block replicated their block builder and relay. So, you know, originally they were going to, obviously. And the reason that I didn't do this under Blocknative was because this network had to be neutral. It couldn't just be, like, you wouldn't get your other block builders on board if you were a block builder yourself.
So, yeah, definitely. It was imperative. I think that's, they're neutral. So the relay does make sense. Okay, so what was the progression like from going nothing to a product?
Yeah, it's always a fun journey. So we actually had a first product called Builder Boost. And this product allowed searchers to pay some on-chain fee and start a stream that, you know, directly just stream data from the block builder's own environment about the block they're building. And at the time, the MEV game or the block building game wasn't strictly, hey, I have my own order flow or my own MEV, and there's this top of block thing that, you know, efficiently extracts arbitrage, et cetera. It was a different game. It was like, hey, you know, the more wallets you're connected to, the more order flow you can surface, the more value you can bring together. So the MEV game was evolving very, very quickly. And during that time, we built this product called Builder Boost that required you to integrate it inside your block builder, basically, right? So that you can stream this data. And two things changed as we were doing that. One, it did get adopted by a major block builder, but they had to kind of change some of the fields because it was leaking too much information that messed up the auction, the MEV Boost auction, basically, or the block builder auction. So it leaked data about, you know, how much fees people were paying. And it unfortunately did that for all top of block transactions. So it became unfeasible to use it without any additional privacy guarantees. And the other, you know, downside of that product was that it required, you know, block builders to integrate it directly. So they would have to, you know, alter their own code, and the integration time was quite heavy. So we had a lot of learnings from that. And you know, then we also met other block builders. You know, this was around a time when block builders were just emerging. They weren't really known, and et cetera. And we met other block builders, and they were like, okay, maybe this product we're not so sure about, but this pre-confirmation stuff, we'd like to do that. So enable us to do that. So again, we listened to the users, the customers in this case, the block builders, and they led us to build a solution. And it's a much better solution because of our learnings from that initial Builder Boost product.
Right. So the TLDR is basically, PrimeV is like this platform, this layer for PBS where builders can basically send their transactions to other builders if they're not going to actually include it, which, let's say I'm a builder at 20%, I'm landing, you know, 20 out of 100 blocks or 2 out of 10, then, you know, for the rest of the blocks, I'm not going to land them. And if I have exclusive deals, then they're not going to actually land. So I have to send it to someone else so they can land. And that's basically what you're enabling, right? It's just a platform for that?
It diverged from that. Those were some of the ideas that we originally had. We had this concept of an order flow exchange that kind of did was going to do what you said. But one, I want to point out that the product's called MEV Commit, and it's, you know, separate from PrimeV because we want MEV Commit to be kind of adopted by the community and become a public good and be decentralized in a similar way to MEV Boost, but even more because there could be a DAO around it, and, you know, all of these MEV actors could join this to coordinate and do things much more efficiently. That's why we've built it in the open. That's why it's, you know, open source and everything. So MEV Commit is the main pushing there, but it doesn't transfer the order flow. It just creates kind of a unified way to interact with block builders and, you know, give them bids to incentivize them to commit to something that you want. And, you know, the most basic case is a pre-confirmation, which means I just want you to include my transaction in your block. Can you commit to this? Right? Here's some bid. Here's some extra money for you to do this. And I interact with you in real time on MEV Commit. Like, I don't have to wait for the block to be finalized or anything. It's more, you know, creating these real-time interactions with those on, you know, we call execution service providers, whether they're block builders, you know, relays, validators, in the case of L2 sequencers, or in the case of Bitcoin miners. So we built this chain abstracted P2P network with an encrypted mempool where you can interact with as many service providers for execution as you want, and in real time get commitments from them for very specific things.
Okay, there's two things I want to touch there. The first one is the pre-confirmation. If I'm giving you, you know, an extra fee to say, oh, you know, commit to my transaction and confirm it, include it, and then they accept that, but then they can't. It just turns out they can't. Although they tried, what happens then?
Well, if they won that MEV Boost auction and they did build a block that went on chain, but they didn't keep their commitment, then they get slashed. So they have some stake in this network.
Which actually, like, they committed to it, but they lost.
If they lost, then right now nothing happens. But, you know, we thought of having a reputation score at the end of the day where, you know, maybe you're committing to things all the time and then you're never delivering them. So your commitments aren't going to be as credible as some of the others. Right now, because the builder market is so kind of concentrated, and they already have a reputation, and you know, searchers and others already submit bundles to them and work with them, the commitment is kind of does hold the reputation behind it, and it is as such credible. But how it materializes is that, you know, people say that they're probabilistic because there's like 2-3 builders or more that you want to get commitments from. But if your bid is high enough, everyone's going to give you a commitment. Granted that these actors are, you know, acting economically rational and have, you know, efficient algorithms to calculate this decision. So,
sorry to interrupt, but like when you just mentioned like multiple parties will commit. So if they're all committing, how do you know? I guess if you only care about just one, like just landing in general, it doesn't matter who it's from. But yeah, I guess what happens when everyone commits to it and then only one of them, you know, actually solve that? Everyone else gets slashed, the reputation falls. It's like everyone's getting wrecked.
Only the winning builder is considered. And I actually had an original mechanism here that I'd come up with. And, you know, we did the A16Z Crypto Startup School last year. And during there, I got to interact with the research team, particularly Tim Roughgarden. And I presented my mechanism to him. And that mechanism had a caveat where any committed builder would receive some portion of the funds, right? So even though they didn't win the block, they would still receive some portion of the funds because I thought it's a more egalitarian way of doing it or something like that. But he kind of pointed out that that's going to lead to a suboptimal auction and it needs to be a winner-take-all situation to align the incentives. The mechanism shifted with his expertise, and it became such that only the winning builder is now considered to be rewarded or slashed.
Right. Oh, okay. Interesting. So everyone else just gets dropped, basically, and there's no punishment at all.
Yes. But over time, you know, you're just not going to consider their commitments as credible. Like even if in the absence of a reputation system, they're just not going to be as material to you.
But is there a limit to it? Because like I don't see any downside to just putting it out there and everyone commits to it. Like, what's the downside of doing that?
No, I don't think there's a downside. Well, the slight inconvenience is that it deteriorates your experience of, you know, making decisions based on commitments that you get. So you want them to be credible, and this notion of credibility is really, really important. So that, and I constantly give this kind of Amazon example, right? Like, Amazon doesn't know that USPS or FedEx or whatever is going to deliver your, you know, box at a certain point. But Amazon gives you this kind of pre-confirmation that, hey, you know, I'm Amazon and I'm so credible that I'm just going to give you this, you know, your order's confirmed thing and you're just going to be fine with it, right? And, you know, then Amazon figures out how to deliver that package to you and, you know, and all that.
Right. It's like an aggregator.
You want that level of credibility. You want to believe that confirmation that you're getting, and you know, all sorts of things can go wrong in the end. Yeah, the package could get lost, it could get not delivered, but you know, most of the time that's not what you care about.
Okay. And why wouldn't someone just, I'm pretty sure Chainbound did this as well, where it just sends to all the builders, the top X builders or N builders. What I'm understanding, it's basically that, where you just send it to all of these builders and they can just go for it. Is there something I'm missing here?
Well, we don't send transactions to builders. We actually don't interfere with the current transaction pipeline.
Okay, let's go through the entire pipeline. We should have done this at the start. My bad. But like, let's go from start to end. What's happening at every step?
The current landscape is that, you know, let's say I'm a searcher. I have a bundle. And actually select which builders I want to send it to. I might not be sending it to all of them because I don't trust builder N, right? So I'm going to pick, you know, 5 builders that I'm comfortable with. Maybe they're the top 5, maybe they're not. And I'm going to send them my bundle. And, you know, hopefully one of them wins the MEV Boost auction and includes my bundle. There are many cases where they might win the MEV Boost auction but not include my bundle or vice versa, right? So once that happens, my transaction is on chain, and you know, there's a whole process with PBS where, you know, the bids go through the relay, and then you know, the proposer asks for this get header request and, you know, gets the header for the block and signs and creates this first kind of commitment game, as we call it, right? So you're making a bid to the proposer and they decide to commit to one of these bids. And that kind of determines the block hash that's going to go on chain next. Now, you might miss that slot or something like that, or the payload might not get there on time. But most of the time, that's pretty canonical that's going to be the next block on the chain.
Like, why would a builder use this?
Well, the current landscape is just, you know, builders using block building algorithms and building blocks and receiving transactions through these kind of RPC endpoints, right? What happens with MEV commit is that you can consider pre-confirmations or other commitment games as net new order flow. You know, it's kind of more bids and more revenue that you can consider to add into your block. So actually, a block builder has no reason not to add it. To them, it's like, you know, accepting transactions from another wallet or something like that.
Yeah.
That requires a little bit more complex decisioning. But, you know, the economic effect is that it's just additive. And then, you know, if they don't over time adopt, new order flow, you know, destinations or sources, then they become disadvantaged in the MEV boost auction because their ability to bid in that auction
is
limited to what they already have only.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's like basically, why wouldn't they add it? Because you're just denying one extra source of, I guess, order flow. Like, I guess, denying a MEV boost or some shit. Okay.
Yeah.
It's a good model. Everyone uses it. Otherwise, other people are at a disadvantage.
Well, there's another angle to it in that validators opt into it. And when a validator opts into it, that means they only use relays that have agreed to filter the block builder bids that they receive to the ones that have registered for MEV commit and have a stake. This means that the block builder cannot, you know, change their address or anything. Like, only the addresses that have registered on there can submit blocks, right? You know, if now it's that validator's turn to propose and you have not registered as a block builder, then you're not going to be able to get your block across to that proposer. You both have the incentives and kind of the proposer's commitment to kind of use this kind of software.
Right. Yeah, it could be like if there's a reputation around it or some kind of system like you just mentioned, and the validators could also just select people from that. Interesting.
Hmm.
And then let's say... Oh, well, I guess if someone commits, they have to land that block. And then if they do land that block, they get reputation. But I'm assuming they also get a small fee for the commitment, let's say a commitment fee. Or is it, do you get a fee at all? What's happening?
Yeah, there is a bid for your pre-confirmation or other commitment game.
Like a little auction thing.
Yeah, that bid gets settled if you deliver on that commitment that you issued. So let's say, for example, say somebody bid at one ETH, you would receive 0.98 ETH and 2% of that bid would go to the DAO treasury. And, you know, if you're active in the ecosystem and whatnot, then you should have a say in how that DAO treasury is used through some tokenization method in DAO.
Cool. So it's like a DAO version of PBS or Flash.
You could say that, but it's additive rather than competitive, right? And
that's
really important because as PBS itself evolves, whether it's one of the efforts that are going on right now or whether it's something like Suave, which is looking like more like an end game, then, you know, this layer is still valid and it's useful, right?
How would you say MEV commit is different to Suave?
Yeah.
Another layer on top of PBS. How does it differ?
Yeah, I mean, it's quite different, actually. You know, MEV commit's designed to kind of engage in these real-time commitment games, right? And it does not have the same hardware, environment that something like Suave is trying to provide, right? And that hardware environment using, Tees gives you the ability to kind of run auctions and have these sealed bids and all sorts of stuff that are particularly interesting and unlocks new design spaces. So we actually participated in ETH London, the hackathon there, and we leveraged Suave to run a blob pre-confirmation auction where you would have this auction and in our model, the relays would participate in the auction for the right to pre-confirm blobs. And then the one that would win would then be able to issue those pre-confirmations on MEV commit. So it was actually a really nice harmony of these two platforms working together. And we ended up winning the prize from Nethermind on our solution. So our goal wasn't particularly to you know, use a solution there, but it just made a lot of sense for us to leverage something like Suave. And I think it demonstrated to the ecosystem both the differences of these platforms, but also how harmonically they can work together.
Okay. Okay. Congrats on the win. Well, dope chicken dinner.
And we get them often.
Okay, interesting. I'm just thinking of how I could break this while just thinking about it or still trying to understand this. Okay, so let's say I'm a builder and my hardware is better than yours of MEV commit. Is there any way I can just win constantly and the people on MEV commit just like fall?
Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah, I guess if I'm also on, if I'm on MevCommit, it's just like another layer. There's not really anything, any other advantage. If everyone uses it, they know they all get the same order flow, basically. It's like a public mempool, except now you're bidding for transactions, right?
Not necessarily, though, because it is a private mempool. It's an encrypted mempool. And it does not mean just because you joined it that the bidders are going to share, you know, their decryption keys with you. So it keeps this optionality that kind of exists outside of PBS today, in that, you know, I can send my bundle only to, let's say, Beaver Build, and that means the other block builders are never getting my order flow. And in the same way, you don't lose this optionality when you're using MevCommit. If you say, hey, I only want you know, rsync or Beaver Build to see my transactions, they're the only ones that receive your decryption key and the ability to read your bids. So it's not public in that sense.
Okay. So, okay. Interesting. So the encrypted mempool. So when I'm a builder and I'm bidding on this pre-confirmation of a transaction, what can I actually see if it's encrypted? And why would I bid on it if I can't see anything?
Well, you can see it because you're the one encrypting it, right? So you have the keys that you're encrypting it. You see your bid and you receive the commitment from the block builder. It's just that others on the network cannot see it. And that gives you privacy and the block builder the privacy.
So just say someone else has bidded higher, but it doesn't say how much?
You wouldn't see their bid. Only the block builders or the providers, as we call them on our network, who they've selected can see that bid. But also other providers on the network can't see your commitment as a provider. And this is very important because let's say you committed to a bid that's worth one ETH, right? For example.
Right.
Now, if other block builders could see this, then they know at a minimum what your block is worth. Now, they know what to bid on the MevBoost auction to kind of increment your bid slightly and beat you, right? So you don't want to leak this block value information to essentially your competing bidders on the MevBoost auction. And this is why it's imperative that you have end-to-end privacy on a protocol, on a pre-confirmation protocol in general, and that we as PrimeMev are not sitting in the middle. You're not sending us your transactions. We cannot see your bids, et cetera. And that's also very important for trustlessness and Mev theft reasons.
Okay, let me break this down. So let's say I'm Titan, you're Beaver. We're both included in this auction, this transaction confirmation. Let's say I bid one ETH. Can you see that bid?
On MevBoost for block bids, yes, I can see that bid, right? And
no, just for the confirmation within MevCommit.
Oh, so the providers wouldn't bid, they would commit, right? So I cannot see that commitment. All I see is some gibberish, basically, right? I cannot see the commitment.
Oh, so then where does the bid come from? I thought that was within MevCommit. You're bidding to get that.
So the bidder is the one who is requesting the, you know, the provider to, you know, pre-confirm the transaction, let's say, right? So I'm a Mev searcher and I'm going to bid to you, Mr. Block Builder, to pre-confirm my transaction and commit to it. Once you make that commitment, then it does not leak information to other block builders on the network. Therefore,
wait, but why would I as a searcher bid for you to include it? Because there's like other people trying to have that block space as well. So I'm like,
exactly.
Oh, so it's like reverse building. So like the players that want the inclusion of the block space are basically bidding for the block space against other people.
Yes. I mean, that's how PBS works today. We're just kind of making that real time.
Yeah. But it's also like black box though, because it, everyone that's competitive just sends to like a private RPC.
Right. So now it's encrypted and it's a mempool instead of the RPC, but it's still private in the sense that you can't see it unless you have the decryption key.
So this is more important for, I guess, like solo searches that don't have exclusive deals. Because like, okay, that's probably the biggest thing that's happening right now is whether you have exclusive deals or not is how, I mean, like a block wins, a builder wins. But if you're a solo searcher, I guess then you make deals and whatnot. But then, you know, maybe your builder doesn't work, like win 80% of the time.
Yeah, it also adds expressivity to deals, right? Like, let's say you have a handshake deal, you pay somebody, you know, $1 million for them to always, you know, include your transaction as you get them or, you know, put it on the top of block, what it is, whatever it is. You can't just, you know, on the fly adjust that deal, right? You can't say, oh, wait a minute, actually, I'm overpaying here. I'm going to give you $900,000 this year instead. Or you can't say, you know, hey, you know, I know you put this on the top of the block, but this next one, you know, put it, you know, slightly under it. Or, you know, for the next three blocks that you're going to build, add transactions A, B, and C in this particular manner. Or when you consider other networks, let's say you have a transaction on Arbitrum and you have another transaction on L1. Now, are you going to also get a handshake deal with the Arbitrum sequencer? Likely not, but the Arbitrum sequencer might opt into something like this where it's observable and, you know, when things settle at least, and then you can kind of programmatically interact with them. So it adds this real-time programmatic nature to these deals.
So instead of me submitting a transaction to a private, you know, to a specific builder or all of them at the same time, or even just sending to a public mempool, I send it to MEV commit and then I select some builders, which could be all of them. And then I pay an extra fee for them to include on top of my priority fee?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I wanna point out this concept of, you know, the bids on MEVCommit are additive. So you don't actually have to send your transaction to MEVCommit. You can send it to whatever you're sending it on today, as long as the builder receives it and they separately get a bid for, you know, let's say in the pre-confirmation case for it to be included in their block. We don't ask MEV searchers to, you know, now start sending their transactions over MEV commit or something like that. They send it as they are. They behave as they do. They just have additional optionality now to influence how that block might be built, right? So
You can. Okay, wait. I just realized. So you can do this like for 10 blocks in advance, right?
Oh yeah, or you know.
Okay.
For you know every day, right? So.
So it's kind of like an option then.
Yeah, it is much more, it behaves much more like an option than
Okay. That's actually super good. Yeah, because there's some like strategies that I've messed around with in the past that specifically happen on a specific time on each day or like a specific day in a month. Sure. So that could be super good instead of like testing and prod and staying up all night to see if your bot works on the one day in the month it actually is available.
All you need is a block number.
I endorse this now.
Appreciate that.
Sick. That's awesome. Yeah. Option block space is fantastic. So how far can they basically like choose to put their transaction in? And also how do they supply it then? Let's say someone picks it up and they guarantee it, or you know, all of them quote unquote guarantee it. What happens then when they have to include it? Is it like I sign the transaction, I just let them have the hash and they can like fuck around with it?
Basically, right, which is kind of the status quo today. But just because you said, hey, you know, a year from now, include this transaction, doesn't mean they're going to accept it, right? So the commitment decisioning is what comes into play here. And the more bells and whistles that you're going to add to your bid, the less likely you're going to receive a commitment, or the more, you know, the higher the bid amount that you have to offer for somebody to kind of commit to that. So it's actually, you know, this is where the game theory comes in, right? Just because the, you know, some of the most pertinent requests that we get are, okay, well, I don't want just an inclusion, you know, pre-confirmation. I want an execution one. Okay, great. Well, you can already express that in your MEV bundle, which, you know, has this, you know, transaction hashes that are allowed to revert field. And then when you combine the MEV commit bid with that, you already can express, okay, I want execution for this. But just because you expressed it doesn't mean you're going to receive a commitment. And then people say, well, I also want a post state route on you know, my transaction. Well, if the block builder has to guarantee you the state, then they like your bid either has to be so high that they would want to do that, or most likely they're just not going to commit to it because they want to keep the optionality to change the state for the most profitable block for themselves. So like I said, the more bells and whistles you add, the less likely the chances of you receiving a commitment are. I also want to touch on this notion of priority fee. So, I mentioned that I worked on this mechanism with a little bit of advice from Tim Rothgard. And my big thesis on the paper that, I went over there with was that, hey, the CIP 1559 thing is actually kind of suboptimal. And, because he had a huge hand in obviously coming up with that, I was a little anxious to his reaction and, how he might react to me saying that as, just researcher with a product background, right? And to my surprise, he agreed with it. And he said, that, yes, there are, many ways to improve this kind of thing. And a real-time system like this could potentially, improve it. So he did agree with that thesis. So at the end of the day, if you want, real-time confirmation or commitment, what you're likely going to do is put some or all of your priority fee into your pre-confirmation bid.
I've actually thought about this a lot, the future block space thing. I'm pretty sure MEV.io was doing this. You kind of front-ran them. Maybe it's slightly different. But this is very interesting because I've always wondered, when you have these confirmations, it's kind of like a limit. Not limit order, like an order book entry where you're waiting to get filled. And then when you can do that, you can kind of create your own MEV. So if you know something's going to happen, well, if you see a ton of these, I guess if it's encrypted, you can't, it's not like order book. I guess this is better than order book. Sorry, I'm like going on a bit of a rant. But like if it's an order book, if I think this kind of solves the order book problem of you see transaction here going to be executed there, but if it's not encrypted, then I could see that and like create my own set of transactions or bundle to create MEV around that transaction that's just sitting in the order book. But if it's encrypted, then that can't happen. So I think that's a great solution.
Well, this is where the program map, you can program the privacy of these bids. Now, that's not live today, but that will come in the future. And Flashbot's done a great amount of work and research here to really put forward ideas on how programmable privacy could work under kind of MEV settings, right? They have MEV share, which, has some early innings of that. And they intend to, I believe, have a full kind of solution under Suave. But, the notion is not just going to be confined to Suave, right? The programmable privacy is likely going to...
Before it leaves my head, I do think this gives more power to builders, though. Because let's say you are a top builder. Now you're getting, it's basically what's happening on PBS, except now you have your own personalized order book for the future of block space. So now you can pre-build blocks. So then it's much faster for them. And now they have more power. And I think even getting into block building would be much harder because they've had so much. I mean, now it's just an extra step of people have to take, whereas these people have established infrastructure, just have to do one more thing, and then they're back on top.
Some of those insights are correct, but this is why we had this original notion of an order flow exchange, where the concept is basically a permissionless order flow auction of some sort, right? Where you would have some encrypted transactions that are just flowing through this mempool. And you would have the optionality to buy the decryption keys. So instead of you kind of having a business development team going to all these wallets or doing these, handshake deals and whatnot to secure order flow, you could just, run a node on this permissionless network and start purchasing some order flow through there and bootstrap your block builder. So we have ideas that kind of balance some of the power dynamics that you point out. However, these are mostly just being inherited from MEV Boost and PBS, right? Like, we're not creating these original power dynamics. Three main block builders practically run the network, and I don't think this is going to change that much.
I think it introduces more power, though, because you are giving them the option to build blocks in advance instead of live. Well, they still do it live, but like, you can kind of just determine, okay, these are going to be an option in there. We don't have to like bring them in instantly. Maybe
eventually we'll see. We'll probably study this on mainnet when it's on mainnet, which should be fairly soon.
Not to say I think this is a great idea, and I think it's gonna be very interesting because no one else is doing stuff like this, introducing new game mechanics. But you did make an article on the commitment game theory, which involves multi-block MEV, instant bridges, like solver-enabled stuff, but also sync commitments. Are these all the things that you've thought about? And also, you know, block-based demands. But is there anything else that you thought about that you didn't include in the article? And I don't think I've ever seen an instant bridge. But let's touch on that and then the thing I said before.
Yeah. You know, there are definitely more commitment games than what I can imagine or what many of us in the ecosystem can imagine today. So this is why we designed MevCommit in a way where, hey, you know, if you think of something that you can just kind of launch a contract and have commitments go into that contract to run whatever logic that you need to for your commitment game. And, you know, some of these use cases we hadn't even imagined until, you know, Bridges came up to us and said, hey, you know, we'd love to look at these pre-confirmations to see if we can make things instant for our bridge.
Oh, Bridges are going to you.
Yeah. And we were like, okay, well, what does that look like? And they were like, well, we have these two issues. One is, you know, obviously we have to wait for the inclusion of a transaction when a user wants to bridge something. And two, that even if it's included, that you, you know, have the chance that it gets reorged, right? So then if I'm going to issue you some coins on this other chain, I need to have some guarantee that, you know, it's not going to get reorged. So today the approach is for them to wait for finalization. And that results in a very poor UX because you're bridging a bunch of coins and you want to buy something over there and you're excited. And then the bridge tells you, okay, you got to wait for like 64 blocks or something like that, right? Yeah. And it's like nobody wants to wait like that. So by focusing on these two areas, one is, you know, obviously inclusion and execution, and two is this reorg, we can solve this problem. And we're not in the business of, you know, creating reorg resistant gadgets, but there are a few out there. And you can combine them with something like a pre-confirmation, and then you solve both these problems to offer that instant user experience. Now, what would that look like? Basically, I'm a user. I go on the bridge, and I say, okay, I'm going to bridge one ETH to this other chain. And as soon as I click it, it should go through because all of this should happen in the background. And some sort of solver should basically absorb that risk in exchange for a premium. So it kind of works like insurance in that sense. Where, you know, let's say the solver kind of calculates that, okay, the risk for this not going through or falling apart is about 10%, then I'll probably pay 10% more in my, you know, fee that I'm paying for the bridge. I mean, this will be embedded in, so it's not like the user will have to make this decision. It'll kind of work like credit card fees where you're just swiping your credit card and there's some fee underneath, right? Yeah. But essentially, all of this is abstracted away from me. As the end user, and all I experience is I click a button and my coins are ready over on the other chain.
Interesting. So is there any fee on actually making, as a user saying, I'm going to make this transaction on block N, is there a fee of any sort? So can I spam that and then cancel it and then like keep spamming that and canceling and changing my address and all this stuff? Can I do that?
Well, you can do that with Ethereum today, right? You know, you run the risk of, well, one, some of those transactions might actually get into a block, you know, when you cancel an Ethereum's
action. Yeah, I mean, you can do that on Ethereum, but like, let's say, you know, someone's got a dedicated amount of resources to doing this, like looking at these confirmations and building a block and predicting it maybe with some AI models. Of what like a typical block looks like and how it inserts within that block. But if you keep canceling and creating it with different, you know, owners and maybe slightly changing the balances to get kind of knock off the model. And if there's no punishment for that, I guess there is trade-offs because doing that would, having a delay would stop that. But then maybe you could add a delay for the longer the commitment is. I'm just trying to think of ideas on the fly. But like as you get closer to the block being confirmed or that block being executed, maybe you like remove that delay or increase it. You can only do like as maybe 3 max or 5 max. I don't know. I'm just trying to think ideas, but I could definitely see a world of spamming to throw off other people so I could win.
Yeah. Well, here's the thing. What if you receive a commitment against one of those? Because then you're kind of on the hook, right?
Can you do a commitment that like says I don't want to be included with this transaction?
So incentivizing censorship, theoretically you can. The platform does not support that, but I mean it is open source, so if somebody wanted to pay someone a lot of money to make sure they do not include a transaction, they, you know, would be able to do that. Now, I don't think most block builders are going to, you know, want to participate in that because they do have reputation-based businesses. And that is likely to get a lot of shade from the ecosystem. So I don't think it would kind of play out in practice, but theoretically, you would be able to edit the code and figure out a way. And if you could convince some builders to do that, then you would be able to. But that doesn't have to do anything with Mev commit or tech. I mean, you could do that today.
Okay.
You could go block builder, pay $1 million and say, hey, never include transactions from this protocol, right? And they might agree to that.
Okay. I am curious, what are like the most challenging things you've encountered while building this? Are there any problems that were super hard to solve and ones that you're still currently trying to solve and even ones that you predict will happen in the future?
Yeah, I mean, there have been many, right? Privacy was a big one. I mean, our cryptography team had to basically come up with a new privacy protocol they call Arube. To be able to broadcast something, but only have a few people be able to read it. We've solved that one. The other one was this fair exchange problem that, you know, some of the common pre-confirmation models are encountering, where you have this really kind of awkward contention between the user experience that you want to provide, which is kind of an instant thing, and the value that you deliver to the network in terms of the block value that the validator gets to enjoy. And when you have an actor in between that is given these pre-confirmations, the actor is incented to give the best user experience to the user, but then that's going to deteriorate the validator's block value and profitability. And if they want to keep that optionality, then they're just going to wait until the end of the block to issue a commitment to the end user, and then who wants a pre-confirmation at the end of the block or after 10 seconds. So we've come up with a decay mechanism that solves this, actually. We leverage both this decay mechanism and the competition in our kind of leaderless system where there's no single leader making pre-confirmations. And this allows the block builders, in our case, or other providers to compete for the right to commit to your transaction, because one, your bid is decaying in real time. So the longer they wait, the less of a value that they can claim to add to their block, which then gives a disadvantage when they're bidding in the MEV boost auction. And this essentially solves this problem where one, your bid decays, and two, the actors, the providers are competing against each other. So they're incented to basically commit to it as soon as possible or likely not commit to it at all. And this really solves this really awkward fair exchange problem that a lot of leader-based pre-confirmation models are dealing with today.
Where do you see the future of MEV going because of this? But also, do you predict anything else being created that might impact the game significantly as well?
Yeah, I think multiplicity is going to be a really important one where the proposer monopoly is broken down. Basically, it's not a single proposer that gets to control the network for that slot.
Yeah.
But it's that there are multiple actors that contribute to it.
I think that'd be super good, actually. But like,
I agree.
It would have to be some sort of randomness, though.
Sure. We have randomness gadgets in Ethereum, though. That is going to break a lot of these models that people are putting forward that leverage the proposer monopoly, right? And that is partially why I'm not a big proponent of those models, because they kind of increase the reliance on the proposer monopoly to solve problems.
Yeah.
I would say the other one, Suave's definitely going to set the stage for how MEV operates for networks and validators that it's adopted in. So I'm fairly excited for that to become a reality. But, you know, there's a lot of complexity that goes on with T's and hardware. So let's see if the folks at Flashbots solve that sooner or later. At the end of the day, I think multiplicity, some sort of encryption or other, new mempool paradigm will be interesting. And then the last one is much more likely some sort of permissionless order flow method where you don't have to do these deals with people or you don't have to have a BD team that goes up to wallets and whatnot to source order flow. It's just that I can bootstrap my block builder much more easier and reduce the barriers of entry to block building. I think multiplicity and reducing barriers to entry to block building are going to be two key pieces to how MEV evolves.
What are your thoughts on order books?
Well, they work. You know, I was briefly a product manager at Polymarket where we launched a a CLOB, you know, centralized limit order book. It allows for liquidity to flow a little bit better than AMMs, I would say, because, you know, people can see what orders there are and they can place size much better, because in AMMs, you disrupt the pool if you have a really big size order, right? Oh. And then you have these backruns, et cetera, that emerge. So order books are great in that sense that, like, let's say I want to put a $100 million order on something. I can't do that in an AMM unless there's actually $100 million in that, like locked in that AMM. But I can with an order book. It can just sit on that order book and somebody can see that. And if they want to take that order or, you know, take that order partially, like they only want to take a million of it, then they can. So order books are pretty powerful in that sense.
Do you ever see, I guess your thing is kind of like an order book, but like without the execution part. Until a block comes.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, you can say for each block that there's an ephemeral order book of some sort that you're able to put bids on. That would be accurate.
Option order book. I wonder if actually making like a public non-encrypted version would be useful as well. Have you thought about that? I'm sure you have.
But I don't think you're going to get adoption because nobody wants to leak their block value, right?
Well, are there... What if, like, you're not just, you give it, you, instead of, like, selecting a few people, you give it to everyone, let it, anyone new come in, and they can see that transaction is going to be executed down the road on that block. So then it's just completely public. Instead of, like, the mempool live, it's the mempool until that block.
Yeah. I think if you have that certainty, if you can provide that certainty, then you can do something like that, where it's kind of like a shared inclusion list, like everybody knows that. Yeah. Transactions are going to go on there. Mm-hmm. But, you know, all of the models that I see about these things and are just actually really terrible. I mean, people are building Web2 APIs to do these things where they like consume my API, co-locate with me. I'm definitely not seeing it before you, trust me, right? It's going to lead to all sorts of timing games and censorship and centralization vectors. So it's important that the need to continue to build things in open ways and decentralized ways is just increasing. And the more centralized RPCs or that I see in the ecosystem, the more wary I'm getting about these second order effects where, well, whoever has a cell tower next to that API is going to consume things much faster and they're going to have an edge that you can't beat.
That makes sense. I feel like, the more you think about decentralized finance, well, not finance, but just decentralization, decentralized networks, you just need encryption. It's just so reliant on it. So it makes sense. Yeah. Public one.
Yeah. And we had a public testnet like in January and until, major block builders started looking at it and they were like, wait a minute, I think my block value is getting leaked here. And we were like, oh, wow, we really got to like encrypt this stuff with a protocol. So it's like, I would say any kind of pre-confirmation solution that does not have some sort of encryption or, this kind of leaderless optionality is going to run into these issues, particularly if they have like APIs or something like that, where you can just consume things faster than the other guy, then you're just going to win more.
Yeah, definitely. Well, I'm super interested to see how this plays out. Seems like it's going to be a very fun game to be a part of.
Yeah, the thing is the downsides aren't really clear to most actors in the ecosystem. Like you have to be fairly sophisticated to understand some of this stuff. And we're doing a lot to educate, people. We're doing a lot to educate researchers, validators. We're making posts here and there that talk about it, including the commitment games one that you just mentioned of the, the perils of adding another API to the game.
Yeah, no, I think it's definitely going to be interesting. Don't stop. Keep going. I want to see more games being played. The PBS game is getting quite boring, so thank you for introducing another toy to play with.
Definitely. I appreciate the reception.
And we'll definitely have another one in the future. But until then, Murat, thank you so much for jumping on and sharing MevCommit with us.
Definitely. I appreciate the opportunity. Thank you for having me.
Of course. And until next time, GNGN.